that metal interview.
Speaking of bassists, plural, you have to mention Mr. Michael Devin of the great White Snake, world-renowned White Snake. Mr. Michael Devin spent some time talking to our podcast with me and myself, James, and he reveals the future of White Snake, the future of Mr. Michael Devin, and he speaks of his experiences with Mr. David Coverdale in the studio, how he broke the ice with White Snake, and working also with the great Lynch Mob, with Mr. George Lynch of formerly of Dokken, and still with Lynch Mob. Of course, you guys heard he's not using Lynch Mob no more. But anyways, let's check out our interview with Mr. Michael Devin. Enjoy.
Man, I was watching an episode of Gear Masters where you're featured, right? I noticed you used to use Ampeg amps in the U.S. and Orange for the rest of the world. Is that because only 250 were made? And have you found any more?
Great question. Right. I actually did locate one more on my travels.
Wow.
I had it set up as an alert, and I can't tell you where I was. I was in the States, I know that. And I did get an alert that there was one for sale. I didn't grab it. It was going to be impossible for me to grab at the time anyway, but I figured two is enough, man. I don't take more than I need, you know? But, yeah, man, I love, the marriage of the two, really. It's just, to me, just a monstrous bass tone. Those particular Ampegs, going through, Orange Cabs, but honestly, like doing the stacking an Ampeg and an Orange and getting a really super duper dirty tone going on one of them and a nice, you know, relatively clean tone on the other, blending it. That would be my dream kind of live tone, but I think they killed that back in the 70s or 80s or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're not, yeah, it's rare to lug out all that kind of gear, at least for, you know, a working stiff like me.
So are you still doing the same thing, Orange, across the world except in the U.S.?
Well, it varies too. I mean, more specifically, to answer that question, what you saw then was I used the Ampegs because domestically they were here and I didn't have to pay for cartage or freight. We had already made all that arrangement. And my Orange, the B-Rig, was in Europe at the time,
yeah.
Which it normally is. So I have Orange over there, which I love because it's, you know, British and born in Britain. I don't know. I got the black Tolex. I was not bold enough to get the Orange Tolex, but not only that, but Jimmy Page rocked the black Tolex. So I figured I'd follow in suit.
There you go.
So I do love the playing of Jimmy Page, yeah. Yeah, man. Yeah.
How did Michael Devin start in the music business? What do you consider the beginning of your career?
The beginning of a career. Man, I don't know. I guess a career is when you start making money, right? That started somewhere, you know, my mid-20s, I'd say, mid to late 20s. When I moved out to Los Angeles, that's when I started to work as a touring musician. Before that, I was living in Massachusetts, in central Massachusetts, spending most of my time, my musical passion began, I don't know, man, I mean, it goes really, really far back. It goes back to my Nana's house. My Nana had a record player in the basement, all Beatles 45s. Nice. And other hits of the 60s that resonate to this day when I hear them. A couple of Kinks 45s and some Petula Clark and Tijuana Brass and It was all this hodgepodge of my mom and her sister and her brother. Like their youngest sister, my auntie Maria, she was a hippie, so she had all this stuff. And I don't know. I started spinning it, and it happened to be the Beatles, so it was very exciting. And what a great teacher, Paul McCartney, man! What a killer bass player! Yeah, very melodic. In Motown, 45s were everywhere in that stack. So, bass somehow, I imagine it. You know, it got into the code early. In those very formative years, it stuck out. I remember the My Girl 45, you know, I just would play it over and over and over. I don't know why, but it's not rocket science why I'm like, I think I'll play bass.
Right.
Yes.
It's a cool instrument. I love the bass. I play bass too.
Do you?
Not as good as you, but, you know, I play some bass.
Oh, come on, man. I'm just a hack with a day job. And the beautiful thing about it is it's a lifelong pursuit, and music is, you know, endless and boundless. And the more you put into it, the more you get back, the more you receive. So it's cool, you know. And bass, man, come on, a badass instrument. I just think it's the baddest, man. I think it's the best because it's that fine line, you know, between the rhythm and melody and harmony, you know. You can hang out with the drummer, or, I mean, man, you can go hang out with the sax player if that's your thing.
Here's another musician question. Also saw the video where you show your Taurus pedals, and excuse my ignorance, but which songs do you play the Taurus pedals on, if I may ask?
No, I don't mind at all. Those are actually what are those? I forget who makes those actual floor, you know, MIDI bass pedals. I know we all call them Taurus pedals, but
yeah,
the actual Taurus is the Moog Taurus synthesizer. So that in itself, it has its own brain. And it has its own foot controllers, and there's a whole world in itself to the Moog Taurus pedal, which is a great and a seriously fun floorboard instrument. I mean, Geddy Lee made great use of it. Yes. The maestro Geddy Lee, an early teacher of mine too. Man, that guy, I thank the world of his bass playing. But anyway, these pedals in the front, the MIDI controller is. Man, I wish I could remember it. If you ever interview John DeServio from Black Label Society, ask him the brand. It's out of Italy. He's got the same brand. It was the cheapest thing. That's why we both got it. Anyway, that's connected to a subfatty, the piece. So there's a Moog subfatty behind the amps. And unfortunately, I can only set it to – it has one voice. I was a couple of tours somewhere around the purple tour, which would put us somewhere in like 2014, 15, somewhere in there. I was doing this, this little bass feature bit, with looping pedals and delays and a whammy and whatever, you know, I was just doing a little bit of that, and so the MIDI controllers came in really handy with that. I was having a lot of fun because it gave me a lot of low end that I could loop using the Ditto, and then I could use my bass for higher voicings and stuff without losing the low. I could never really get it together though, because we were shy channel strips, and so the only sound you were ever getting was what was off the deck or off the mics come, you know, or maybe the DI, let's say. But you're getting, even with the DI, you're only getting the unaffected signal. So it's not that cosmic wash that I was hearing on stage or whatever with a bunch of delay going and yada, yada. It was, God only knows what it sounded like out front, you know what I mean? But it was short-lived nonetheless. That was my introduction of like, okay, what do I do to fatten up the low end while I try to do some whammy, you know, some high register stuff, which sounded cool. Anyway, the bass feature, we didn't need it anymore. We went on the next tour. It was a greatest hits tour. So we just did a tight set with, who were we out with? I don't know. We were out with somebody, but our set was maybe Def Leppard. So, I never went back to that bass bit Mojo Man, I think Coverdale ended up calling it Mojo Man. But we actually ended up doing a bit of a writing session with it at Saddlebow at his, not Saddlebow, Hook City at his studio. In any case, it's still there. I still play them. I use them for intros, outros, just places where you could use. Also, the guys have a feature, a guitar feature. So Reb and Joel, do that gun slinging thing, whatever you want to call that. That whatever that is, that showdown. Right? Uh-huh. So there are these musical interludes to sort of cue the other guy when to go, and I play the changes with Michele, who's on keys at that time, and Tommy Aldridge. We just hit these chords. I have fun at that point in the show with the sub fatty, because that's when I can twist knobs and like play with tone, and you know,
cool.
Sometimes it's overly obnoxious, but what are you gonna do, man?
That's cool. Very cool.
yeah, man. Yeah, you know, you try to mix it up there. You know, I mean, it would been. Well, no, I mean, that was about 10 years there now with Whitesnake. So,
well, that sounds fun. That sounds very fun.
Oh man, good fun. You know, great fun. And you know, it's like anything. I mean, not like any job. Obviously, if you love what you do, you love what you do. And I love to do that. Yeah. So, it's up to you to make it enjoyable, right? I mean, any job can be a bitch. It can, you know, right. It can be horrible, right? But mixing it up is key, I think, in whatever capacity you can do that. Separating your tours as memories is, my advice. If there is ever to be, God willing, a tour circuit where we all get back out there roller skating together again, it's good to like mix it up every tour in some fashion.
Awesome. I've seen some interviews with you, and you seem very down to earth and grounded. Considering you play with Whitesnake, one of the biggest names in the world, how do you maintain grounded, man? I mean, you're supposed to be big headed or something. you're so down to earth. You're so down to earth, man.
Oh man.
How do you do that?
Well, man. Thanks. But I don't really have a magic answer for that. I honestly don't. I guess I just follow my gut instinct to navigate my way through life most of the time, and that I suppose is connected to some form of whatever you would like to call it. Everyone has a word for it these days. I'll stay away from the three-letter word. I'll use the word higher intelligence. I think people like that better for some reason. A higher power. Uh-huh. So, you know, if you can start to open your mind and your heart, because that is the most intelligent organ in your body, not the matter between one's ears, but the heart. If you start to open that, which is not as easy, it's easier said than done, you have no choice but to ground yourself. You're completely astonished by the magnificence and the sheer size of one's own life, never mind the life of the cosmos or the idea of God or existence or where we happen to be, whether it's a pimple on a dog's ear inside of a, you know, bubble that's floating inside of some kind of cup that's suited for, I don't know, giants to drink out of,
right.
Or it's merely just something more subtle than that and ready to inform you if you start to listen to it. That's what connects me to music, man. I mean, I don't just show up, honestly, in some kind of like mode of humility because I was born this way. I didn't grow up like some monk, man. I was a fucking terror. I was a terror, my brother. I was wild, and I was, you know, I was out of control in some ways. I could not be, you know, I believe they what do they call that? They would call me, you know, an incorrigible, you know, right. A narrow, well, right? A juvenile delinquent, a hood, you know. But
really?
that was just the surface. There was some of that, but we grew up in a small town. So my friends and I, you know, we spent our time listening to music, and this is pre-internet. So a lot of the rock lore came from books and magazines and your older brother's hearsays, and, you know, man, yeah. It still had this magic and this kind of mystical quality where, you know, if you were brave enough to enter, you know, in some regards, at least coming from where I did, man, there's no promise. I didn't grow up on Hollywood and Vine or anything. Not that anybody who did had any edge, but I'm just saying, like, I grew up in the woods where it was pretty, you know, it's just backwoods, man, backwoods mentality. Just so music provided the escape and also a large part of, in some degree, some kind of information that there's more than meets the eye than what we're being taught and told. And to be honest with you, I suppose there was a part of me that always had a bit of a rebellion or a questioning of authority. I think I entered the planet with that. And I went to a Catholic school, and I was born into a very Catholic family in, you know, the Boston area. And so it's taken a lifetime to sort out, you know, dogma from true, you know, yeah, spirit, soul, whatever you want to call it. And that's a very individual process, you know. But, you know, man, it's like music was this doorway. It was an entryway, and it was way more than some career. I didn't even know what that meant. None of us did. So, you know, to enter the realm of, say, you know, Jimi Hendrix when it's 1988 or 9, and I, you know, it was passé for some people, but for some of us, it was completely mind-blowing, earth-shattering. Or to hear Black Sabbath 1 was just like, what was that? I was so floored. And to hear Led Zeppelin 4, you know, was just, at first, listen, I didn't get it except for maybe one song. And then, you know, to be honest, man, I went and within 6 months, I probably had smoked some ganja. I came back to the Zeppelin catalog and went, wow.
Yeah. Classic stuff.
Yeah. Yes, man. I suppose it all has its place. But yeah, man. So yes, it's been amazing to go on this journey with Whitesnake and everybody I've played with, you know, to come from that and enter the realm of, you know, the professional life, as it were. Man, how do I walk around like, yeah, you know, what, like I own the fucking place?
Right.
I don't own the place, man. Little Richard owned the place.
Great answer. Awesome answer. So how did you, for the people that don't know, how did you get the Whitesnake gig? How did that come about?
Well, I suppose the short answer is Brian Tichy. I mean, that's kind of the shortest answer I can give you, really, because it all stems from him, really. He and I were playing at the time with George Lynch. Brian's a drummer, by the way,
yes.
Who's played with Ozzy, Foreigner, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
A ton of bands, Whitesnake. So he'll kill me for not being able to rattle off more than that. But anyway, Brian and I have known each other a long time. I met him right when I got to LA somewhere. And I think we probably met in 2000, maybe, or one. And I got here in like 99. So we found ourselves, you know, playing a lot. And we were, I had joined his band. He had a power trio called Ball with a drummer named Joe Travers, who's a phenom, man. Joe Travers is just a badass drummer. If you don't know who he is, but Zappa, he played with Zappa plays Zappa and Dweezil, Missing Persons. And Joe is the Vaultmeister at the Zappa estate.
Okay.
And he's an incredible drummer. Yeah. But anyway, that was kind of my first, you know, what I thought was my first, you know, legit gig here, because the riffs were cool and the players were fucking cool. The playing was cool. So, in any case, we forged a friendship, and then he gets in Whitesnake. I got into another project when he joined Whitesnake, and I was very excited. We were both on the road with Lynch, and I had auditioned for Jason Bonham's Led Zeppelin Experience. Yes. Now it's the Evening, but then it was the Experience. And just through this really amazing, you know, quote-unquote coincidence that I would need a roommate at my jam spot, and I was down to the wire. I was just about to have to let it go. I put an ad up, and someone had answered it like that week. And long story short, it was Zoe. It was Zoe Bonham. It was John's daughter and Jason's sister.
Oh, wow.
And so, and she came in and just really like just swooped in and like scooped up the room and saved me and saved the whole thing. I don't even think she knows this, but in any case, she hit me up one day and said, want to have a jam with my brother? And I said, absolutely. Would I,
Wow.
I mean, I'm a bona fide Zepp head. I would definitely qualify as one of those.
Yes.
So, it was a 4th of July weekend, and he hit me up with, real quick. And he said, what Zeppelin songs do you know? I rattled back probably a good, 25 or 30. And then he rattled back the other remaining 30 that I didn't mention and said, here, learn these or something. It was like, oh, okay, this is going to be fun. Like he wants to play, like he wants to do deep cuts. Wow. We were like, T for One. And, we were working up all kinds of things, man. Nice. Poor Tom. We didn't get to play it live, but, some of them, but we did work them up. Anyway, long story short, man, I was living in, Venice Beach at the time and just woodshedding, man, Zeppelin on 4th of July weekend. While all these fireworks are popping off over my head, I'm just in between the speakers going over each album, man. I was so psyched. And then, I went in that, whenever that was, that Monday, and met the guys. Tony Catania was on guitar at the time, TC. And Tony, man, great player, just a really, really great guitar player. James Dillon on vocals, who's still singing with the project. And great singer, great guy. Love James. He's a brother. My bud Dorian Hartsong is now on bass there. After I left, he, I knew he was a bona fide Jonesy guy too. So he'd already known the set list. I was kind of sending him set lists, just like, man, you never know. You never know. And wouldn't you know? So
right.
He stepped right in, man. And he's been there ever since. But
nice.
That's how it happened. I mean, long story long. Yeah. It's Tishy, he was already in. David asked him, who are you playing with, and Lynch, and he said me, and David was curious because he never heard of me, and I had to video record a concert that night and send it to him, and
wow,
and that got the ball rolling. That was for the Forevermore. That was 2010.
10, right? Yeah. Wow, congrats on that. Wow, what an honor. Awesome.
Yeah, man. Yeah, man, Coverdale, man. I mean, he's cutting his teeth in Deep Purple. That's, hey, man, he's,
oh, yeah,
hats off.
He's a living legend.
Not to mention, he's a great fucking singer, man. He's laid down some amazing, amazing vocals throughout the years, man.
So how did it feel when you first met David, the first time you put your bass on? And of course, you guys must have rehearsed, or did you go straight on stage and...
You mean like the very first time I met him?
Yeah.
No, we didn't go straight on stage. No. No, but he did put, no, not even a rehearsal, no.
Oh.
But no, he did put me to the task right away, but it was in the studio.
Nice. Wow.
Yeah.
How did that feel?
That was a different.
Sitting in front of Coverdale, how did that feel?
Well, you talk about a different kind of pressure.
Yeah.
I would have preferred a live jam, You don't have to say much. You can just play. But, man, I'll tell you what. He disarmed me immediately. And he, who I thought I was going to meet was not the man that I ended up meeting at all. But he's a very warm-hearted guy, and he's very inviting. And he's You know, man, he's full of life, fire. You know, he's jovial. Wow. He's British, man. He's got the wit. He's got like that sharp, fast humor. He's got like that Beatles humor, man. It's the dude is a funny man. Man, he is. Oh, seriously, one of the funniest guys you'll ever.
Wow.
Yeah, if you're around him, you know, enough to, you know, for him to drop a line. Oh man, come on, yeah, he's funny. Yeah.
Well,
but yeah, man, we talked. We're both kind of Beatles freaks and British Invasion freaks and Motown freaks, so we didn't have any problem like hitting it off. We, you know, we got to talking right away, really. And I was completely at ease. So by the time I went to the base to listen to what they had been working on for what would be the release of Forevermore, you know, I was totally cool. And I mean, yeah, I was nervous, but no more. I mean, you know, a little less than I had been walking in the door. Because he was cool. He put me at ease. He was totally chill. And Doug Aldridge was at the helm of recording up in Tahoe at the time. So he was there, and he was cool. You know, Doug's still a bro of mine. You know, yeah. We still talk regular. But yeah, man, that was a bit. You know, man. Here, what would you play to this? Okay, great. Here, what would you play to this one? Okay, great. What about this one? How about that one? How about, you know, it's like I'm writing down chord changes with my left hand and like trying to play along with my right, you know. But I don't know how I even got through it, but I somehow did. And then they threw me in the vocal booth. Yeah, Michael, let's see if you can sing. You know, it's like 8:30 in the morning, man, you know.
Really?
I was up, yeah, and I'm on the road at the time with Lynch. And so, I mean, we were up. Lee, I'm a night owl, brother, so yeah. As it is. So, you know, Eddie, you know, when I was talking to David, I was probably, you know, somewhere down here. So he's like, you know, you really give it to me on this one. All right, you know. And, dude, I was so, so shy on the mic. I mean, forget about it. It wasn't going to happen. So he comes into the booth. Now I'm really sweating. There's no AC in there, bro. Wow. So I'm like, ah. And he comes in, and it's only big enough for one.
Right.
So he's like right in there, and he's like, well, all right, look. So he's like, when you sing this, you do it like this. And then he just fucking blasts. So, like, right in my face. So loud a volume and like, body to the tone. It's like that old pub singer, man. He's got like those kinds of pipes. It's like old school fucking sing over the drum kit, you know.
Wow.
And yeah, it's kind of vibe, and I'm like, wow, okay. So I couldn't do it, but in time, over the course of years and the touring, and I didn't come out of the gate a singer, man. I was in the back with the drummer, man. I played bass, you know. Yeah. If you wanted me to sing, I could pipe in, but I certainly didn't volunteer, man. I wasn't that kind of a little bit reserved. I'm a little bit,
yeah.
But he didn't have any time for that shit, man. He was like, nah, no, you will be singing. I'm like, okay. And
wow.
That's kind of how it went, bro. It was awesome. He sat through my entire vocal take on that first album anyway, he did, just to ensure I was cool. And yeah, man, and he just kept cheering me on. I swear to God, man, he just kept he kept yelling the boner, you know. So when I would do it right, I'd keep doing it, and then he'd go boner, and I'd be like, all right, we got it, and I'd move on. So
wow, what an experience, man. What an experience.
Yeah, dude, those were good times. Yeah.
Also, I saw you mentioned in one of the interviews, you mentioned a ritualistic thing, a ritual with your wristband. What's the reason behind the wristband deal? Just a habit, or?
Oh, you mean that leather, that piece of leather probably at the time I was wearing.
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah, yes, I guess. I like, yeah, sort of superstitions, yeah. Or maybe, but you know, pre-show rituals, I guess I was probably referencing, and I think every musician ends up developing one, whether they realize it or not, you know, and I certainly have one. I suppose the accoutrement you'd be donning for the concert becomes, totemic in a sense, and then it becomes important, and you need to kind of wear it because it completes the suit. It's like if Superman's like, fuck, where's my cape? I mean, is he really going to go out there and be like, yeah, I'm going to kick your ass? He's probably going to be like, fuck, where's my cape?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah. I have since retired that thing, though, dude. That thing started to smell like, I don't know, I was burying something underneath the house. It was like, time to go.
So. Right. Okay. Changing bands, I suppose, From the Earth. Great stuff. Great material, man. Talk to us about that project, From the Earth. How did that project start? And can you give us fans an update on that?
Oh, thanks, man. That started as just a series of sessions that ended up getting compiled into, I don't know, a semblance of an EP or two EPs. I wouldn't necessarily call it any kind of a pointed album. You know, it was just exercises, I suppose, in like song craft and stuff, and just other some of them were exercises in trying to express, like, I don't know, on the spot, live, off the floor. So then that was fun and challenging, and I went to New Jersey to do that with a producer friend of mine, Warren Riker. And Warren's great, man. And he's a madman. He really is a mad scientist, especially when you get him in the studio environment. So it was he and I basically, and a drummer, and we had some guest musicians, you know. But basically, it was he and I doing just building these ideas and sketches, you know, from the ground up, which was a great challenge, at least to myself it was. I didn't have really anything to hide behind. It gave me the confidence to move forward, no doubt about it. Not being someone who, again, you know, I've always focused on trying to be a good supportive musician in an ensemble. You know, I certainly didn't have any like youthful goals and desires of being lead, you know, any kind of lead songwriter or singer or anything, or, you know, anything like that. These are just things that have developed out of my need to express as an artist or whatever. But all that gobbledygook aside, man, it's just trying to find the tone. I'm just trying to find the tone I hear in my head, and I haven't found it yet. So I have music. Absolutely. And I've been working on it and writing it since we've put the brakes on Whitesnake on our world tour. Will it be called From the Earth? I don't know. Probably. Will it sound like the other songs? Probably not. Uh-huh. You know, I'm not married to any kind of wardrobe or, you know, stickers, right. You know, bumper sticker mentality. I just love music.
Yeah.
I mean, all musicians do, you know, man. I mean, if you're a lover of music, man, you just love music. And I am, I'm a fan of it. So I love those EPs and From the Earth because it definitely laid a bed for me.
Good stuff. Very good material.
A foundation. And thank you, my brother. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And you know, it also forged a relationship and a friendship, with Riker. I already had one, but you know, now, I mean, he's my bro, and we continue to work on things together, and other people who were involved that are still there, and it's really cool that at a time now, you know, God, you know, I'm trying not to go there. By the way, I don't really want to. I don't want to spiel about it, but it is a very it is a very unusual time for all of us.
Right.
And, you know, for the number of us who were out there, you know, rolling around in the buses and vans playing music.
On tour,
yeah. Yeah, on tour. That's coming to a complete standstill has opened up all of this time to go deeper, right? And in whatever way that is, it doesn't – I speak, you know, I guess for everybody in that sense, that could be somebody just has a regular day job. I mean, this is an opportunity in a time as strange as it is for certain things to slow down a bit inside the mind, you know, life. And touring, that circle, that cycle, it's you're always fitting things in to coincide with that, you know. Now all this time to sit around and like really – really work on song ideas and really, you know, sit with melody and sit with a change. It's really awesome to have that time. I'm getting a lot out of it. I'm going deeper with music creatively than I have in the past. So, yeah.
Awesome.
I'm excited about
it. Just very strange times for sure. We do have a lot of time. So hopefully we can see some new material from you, huh? Either from the earth or how about this band, Sun Something Unto Nothing?
Sure.
How about that?
Yeah, Sun. Sun. How about Sun?
Any update on that?
My friend, no, although I do still speak to the members of Sun. I mean, shy of Tommy Stewart, I'm sure he's okay. I mean, I'm not sure about that, but I hope he's okay. Hey, Tommy, sure was. I doubt it, but anyway, Tommy was great, though. What a good dude, Godsmack drummer. But he rounded out that project live on the recording. You know, a bunch of it was Tishy on drums, and then me on bass, and Sass coming in and just putting her creative genius all over it. You know, and she's awesome, and we talk all the time on the regular. Her and I have never stopped being friends. She's a one of a kind human being and a really good person on planet Earth. So, you know, I'd take her any day, you know, as a teammate. Loads of fun, like loads of laughs. We had a lot of fun making that record. We did. We had a lot of laughs. So, yeah, for that I'm always, and I had a great time playing bass on it. I enjoy the bass playing on it. You know, it was loose and free and fun, and I'd been playing with Brian for so many years by then that we, you know, we just sort of did what it was, came natural to us, and I think it locked in pretty good. You know, so yeah, is there to be another Sun album? Doubtful. You know, I would say highly doubtful.
Really?
Yeah. I don't think. I think if that was going to happen, it would have. You know, that's the only reason why I say that. If there were opportunities for that to have happened, and they came and they went. So, you know, and some things, look, man, some things are just better left to be what they are as, you know, creative milestones, you know, or whatever in people's lives, or at least just these, you know, touchstones that, you know, I was here then, you know. Yeah. But yeah, it doesn't mean you need to keep creating with the same dynamic or anything, unless I guess we had become some huge success, and then there's the business side of that and the pressure to remain a creative force. But we all went off and did other things, right? Like right after we did that, everybody had to go off and do their thing. I was still in Whitesnake. Brian had left Whitesnake by then, so he was off doing whatever he was doing, and Sass, you know, went off to do Sass because that's what she does. She performs as herself, you know.
So, right.
Yeah.
Great singer. Great singer, by the way.
Fantastic singer and great lyricist. I think the world of her words because I know how she gets them. And I'm a writer, so I'm always sniffing around like a dog, like where, you know, where's your honeypot? Like, how do you get your words? You know, like, what, you know, and because I painstakingly suffer over them in my brain. They just, like, I can't stop it, and I wish I had a magic book that would be able to just show me words, but that's not what it is. But she has her own process, which is equally, probably as painful, but, like, brilliant. Like, she just goes up in front of a mic and just starts, like, I don't know. It's not scatting, because, like, a good percentage of it ends up being the lyric, at least in that environment that I watched her do it.
Wow. Very talented.
Which, very talented, because, you know, I know Jagger has a similar flow, and I only know this through, you know, lore, but I forget who was telling the tale.
Jagger, you mean some, Mick Jagger?
Mick, I'm sorry. Yes, Mick Jagger. Yes. Someone was telling the story of watching them record Brown Sugar, and how he was just sitting on the floor as the band's jamming, because, you know, the Stones would do multiple takes. Mick is just writing giant in letters on these big yellow legal pads, you know, words as they're coming, but he's literally spitting them out into the mic. So you talk about hot, you know, fresh out of the oven, you know,
yeah,
hot off the pan. It's like, that's pretty brilliant, man. I got to be honest. You know, I mean, every you know, buddy has their process. I'm sure Bernie Taupin had his, because he's another genius lyricist, but his was a little more of a contemplative process, as I watched it in a little bits of things about him. But I see Mick, I read these things about Mick Jagger just spitting it out, and there it is. And then maybe they go in and they fix a few lines, you know. But that's how it was with Sash Jordan. I saw that a bunch. I was like, wow, that's crazy. You just spit that out, and there it is. There it lives, you know.
Is there a message you would like to send to your fans out there listening to this podcast?
Yes, I would like to say to any of the fans out there that, firstly, I miss you a whole bunch, and I wish we were out there this summer, as was planned, to be globe-trotting. This global shift hasn't been easy, but we'll get through it. I have hope. Absolutely. And we'll be seeing each other again for sure. So, and I'm sorry if I've been very silent on social media. I really am. My apologies to anyone listening who might be trying to write me on there. I just had to, you know, just turn the frequency a little bit for a while. So, yeah. Anyway, no disrespect meant or no harm meant. I'm just, yeah.
Awesome.
Focusing on the exam, my brother. But it's been great to talk, and thank you very much for this opportunity, man, really, to blather on with you.
It's
sorry
an honor.
If I chewed your ear off, bro.
You're good. It's just an honor to speak to a rock stardom and you know, a talent as yourself. Thank you for making some time, Michael. Appreciate it.
You're very kind, my brother. Peace and love to you, man. God bless, man.
Big thank you to Mr. Devin, Mr. Michael Devin, the great talent of Whitesnake. A tremendous talent, a very down-to-earth person that you guys heard. We hope you guys enjoyed this. And don't forget to follow us on social media. Instagram, Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, Reddit, Snapchat. The digital stuff for our podcast, which is iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, TuneIn Radio, Spotify, Deezer, and so on and so on. Those of you that follow us on YouTube, our page is available for you guys to follow, subscribe, ring the bell. That Metal Interview Podcast with myself, James. Thank you, Mr. Devin, and rock on, Whitesnake. And don't forget to keep it metal.
That Metal Interview.